in the final years of his life, he had this idea that all of the arts should come together in his operas,
mm-hmm.
the visual, the poetry, the idea that the music should almost be subservient to all of these other art forms.
Mm-hmm. Not really subservient, because the music was very important to him. He was really a polymath. I mean, he wrote on vegetarianism. He was a political writer. He himself was a cultural movement and had an enormous ego. But the music was very important for him. I love Mark Twain's statement that Wagner's music isn't as bad as it sounds. And also Woody Allen once said that every time he listens to Wagner, he wants to invade Poland, which I think is true. So no, he's really known for his music more than his political writings and for the other things that he did. But the music was paramount, and that's why at Bayreuth he wanted the whole aesthetic experience to come together. So he hid the musician so that you would see the visual, but that the music would be so compelling and move you aesthetically and emotionally.
He's still a phenomenon.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I mean, his music, he's really the first modernist composer. I mean, he really is responsible, for better or for worse, for people like Schoenberg, for Stravinsky, for the abstract tonalists of the 20th century. In fact, he didn't like the whole notion of opera because it was too tied to the Italian tradition. So he called it music. What he did was music drama. He invented a whole new word for it and did not really eschew the whole concept of opera itself, which he wanted to change.
And he had this entire holistic view, which was unusual at the time.
The Gesamtkunstwerk.
Right. And, right. And I mean, Mozart and Puccini, they all mm-hmm. they had their own mm-hmm. librettists, their own lyricists. He was clearly good enough to take on everything.
He did. He did everything. He was,
and did it all well.
He did it all well. I mean, he wrote the libretto. He did the music. He did the staging. He wanted to conduct. He wanted total control of the opera itself. And the uproar over Tannhäuser in Paris in 1861 was the fact that he wouldn't introduce a ballet into it, which was the entr'acte. And this is where the members of the Jockey Club would come. If you look at Degas' pictures, you understand that, because the ballet was not a separate art form. It was really the entr'actes in between the opera itself. And he felt that an opera music...
You mean a ballet?
A ballet, yes, would be ludicrous. So he did the Venusberg music, and he went right from the overture, which the Parisians had liked before because it's actually melodic, into, without any kind of interruption, into the Venusberg scene, which was shocking because it was erotic and it was also atonal.
When I contacted Temple's music school and said, have you got somebody who can speak knowledgeably about Wagner, they put me in touch with somebody who used to be the dean of the visual arts school. Explain, please.
Yes. Well, I was actually invited by the Philadelphia Museum of Art to do a lecture on... was an endowed lecture, and I was working on a painting that they said, no, we want you to do something from the collection. So I'd not worked on late Manet, and it was the portrait of Emily Ombre in the role of Carmen, which one curator says has actually more frequent flyer miles than he does because it's lent out so much. It's a wonderful portrait. So there was nothing much written on the portrait, and I looked into it, into Bizet, and I began to find all sorts of connections. So I began to write a book on Manet and music. And I came to the music in the Tuileries and somehow made the connection. I realized that in this painting, which is in the National Gallery in London, all the little small portraits on the left-hand side were all the first Wagnerian supporters and practically the only ones. And I thought, well, what would happen if I looked, I read Baudelaire's essay on Wagner in Richard Wagner and Tannhäuser in Paris. I read Gautier. I read Champfleury. And it opened up this painting, which is considered by Clement Greenberg to be the first modernist work of art, Manet's painting. So the chapter, which was the fourth chapter of a book on Manet and music, got to be over 150,000 words, I thought, oh my God, this is not ending. And I think anything on Wagner should be long and complicated and not come to an ending. So the chapter actually became a book on Manet and Wagner.
Have you finished it?
It is finished. It's in production, yes. It's never finished. In fact, I had to cut it down because it was too long. And I thought, well, I just sort of got a German persona underneath my Irish skin because it just got so long and complicated and I could have just kept writing it. But Wagner is such a compelling thinker. And I do think that Manet was aware of his art.
What happened between you starting with this, I won't say limited knowledge, but less knowledge of Wagner, and the end of the book. What were the surprises? What were the things that really came home to roost?
Well, the three largest bibliographies are on Jesus Christ, Napoleon, and Wagner. And I was working on, you know, as a Catholic, I guess I work with Napoleon III and Wagner, so I'm just doomed for the rest of my life to be reading, which I absolutely love to do. What surprised me were the consonances between this painting and what Wagner was trying to achieve. And what I found in writing the book was in looking back at the French critics who critiqued Wagner, the same, very often the same writer would write about art and music for the same periodical. And when they wrote about Wagner, they wrote about color and art, and they used art comparisons. And then when they came to write about Manet, they often used musical comparisons. And I found that very interesting. And so by studying those two together and by looking at the whole concept of modernity, which is non-narrativity, continuousness, this painting by Manet is very different. It's considered the hallmark. It's considered like the first Impressionist painting. It influences Renoir in the Moulin de la Galette. It influenced Monet and others. And Manet doesn't go back to that style until the 1870s. There are very intriguing parallels that you can make between Wagner and Manet at this point. And Manet began the painting right after Wagner's opera was performed in Paris. He was also going every day to the Tuileries with Baudelaire. And Baudelaire was nuts about Wagner. He felt that he had that he knew Wagner before he had even heard his music. When he heard his music, he said, "I've composed that too in my head." And what Baudelaire does in a very interesting passage on his in his essay on Richard Wagner and Tannhäuser in Paris is that he talks about the visual ideas that happen when you're listening to it. And in many ways, he invents a Barnett Newman stripe painting. He sees Wagner, one passage of Wagner, as a continuous spread of red with a white stripe down the middle, you know, lightning strike down the middle. I'm like, it's a Zip painting. It's Barnett Newman. It's amazing.
So 100 years before anybody would actually paint it, he had conceptualized it.
Yeah.
In the latter part of his life, I mean, clearly this is a composer who's famed for his operatic or his music dramas. In the latter part of his life, a local connection, 1876, the Centennial World's Fair, and a Philadelphian goes about commissioning a work for this Philadelphia
event. Yes, the Centennial March. Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the background to that.
Well, it was very surprising. It was an American woman who commissioned somebody, actually a German man, and said, you know, she wanted to commission a march. And so they went to Wagner. And it's not a well-known piece at all. It's very rarely played. There is a recording of it on YouTube, and it's a rather pedestrian work from him. You can tell that his heart wasn't in it. It was in 1876, of course, that he was building Bayreuth, and he was just preparing for the first production.
So he was looking for money.
He was looking for money. He was always in debt. He was always in debt. The man was a total spendthrift. If he got one mark, he spent five, because he liked to dress well, he liked to eat well, he liked to hang out at Café Tartoni, you know, which would be instead of eating on a McDonald's budget, he's eating at Le Bec Fin every night on nothing. And so he always overspent, and he was always very good at wheedling money out of others to subvent him. But he died, you know, practically in debt because he always overspent.
So do we know how much this commission was worth? Was this really
well, he got
a mercenary
paid $5,000, which was an enormous amount back then. Of course, he said that Verdi was getting $100,000 for his work. I don't think so. I mean, I think that those numbers are inflated, but he didn't like Verdi. I think he used to call him Merdi, if I'm not mistaken. But he was always very jealous of others. He was megalomaniac to the nth degree and always talked about himself. So he charged $5,000 for this 12-minute piece of music. And it was played at the when Roosevelt came to the World's Fair. And hundreds of, I mean, again, it was a typical Wagnerian production, 150-piece orchestra. I mean, God forbid you should have, you know, three oboes and a drum. And then he also wanted a cannon to be set off at the end of it, you know, off stage. I mean, you know, in other words, the bombast was still there. The critics for the newspaper felt that there was no American sort of feeling in that. Well, what did they expect? They commissioned a German to do it. But they felt he could have been more deferential and tried to get some perhaps American folk music, the way that Dvorak does, for example, in the New World Symphony, is somebody who, you know, picks up. I mean, it's clearly Dvorak's music, but there are American traditions in it. And Wagner, of course, did not do that.
So it's debuted at Centennial Hall, which ironically later on the Philadelphia Orchestra uses as a recording studio in the 1970s.
Yes, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You say it's underperformed. Is that code for it's not very good?
I think so. Yes, I think so. It is really, in listening to it and knowing Wagner's music as well as I do, because I'm a huge Wagnerian fan, is that it is, there's nothing special about it. There is nothing. I mean, Wagner's music is so compelling. It has a lot of emotional color to it. And this is a sort of straightforward, you can just tell, like, okay, this is just an exercise for him to do. And it's really undistinguished as a march. I you know, that's my opinion. I'm not a musicologist, I'm an art historian, but I've been listening to Wagner for about 20 years and very intensively. And it certainly, it has really, you know, filtered down to the bottom of the pile.
It's interesting, though, that somebody who was so controlling and so egomaniacal about everything that he did would allow something just like this to slip out and just, I mean, it was a fairly prominent commission, mm-hmm. because in those days, world's fairs meant something.
Yes.
This is where the world did gather.
Right.
And this was perhaps a place where he was going to be exposed.
Mm-hmm. I think he ran out of time. He wrote it in a very short amount of time because, again, he was so involved in the building of Bayreuth, which is a very complex undertaking, and trying to, again, to attract the world to Bayreuth, and indeed did. I know Fantin Latour actually postponed, he was an artist of the 19th century, actually postponed his wedding to go to Bayreuth to be at the opening, and just wrote beautiful articles for La Revue Wagnerienne about it. So it was that was where his heart was, because this was going to be Wagner Incorporated. And to do this little commission, which is a one-off kind of deal, was not that important to him at that time. I think he was pressed for time. So he saw it as a money-making venture rather than something that he was going to invest in.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.